You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Have you ever seen a novel word and despite a lack of training in formal Latin or Greek, you immediately understood its meaning? This is how people often feel when they see the word Zubiquity. Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD, Director of Imaging at the UCLA Cardiac Arrhythmia Center, coined the term. It's meant to promote the concept that the health of all animals is interconnected. She believes veterinarians and MDs working together, looking at overlapping health issues, is needed to ensure that all life thrives rather than just survives. I'm honored to have as my guest Barbara Natterson Horowitz, MD, the author of the new book, Zubiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
X-Power is a global brand that offers a complete line of stand dryers, cage dryers, and multiple blasters that cater to both home and professional groomers. Designed to be quiet, lightweight, and powerful, X-Power pet dryers will save you time, energy, and money. The X-Power B2 Pro at Home Dryer is the perfect holiday gift for family and friends. Please check out our holiday specials at ViperPet.com and Amazon.com. For more information, visit xpower.ws or call 855-855-8868.
It's the holidays at PetSmart, so come one and all. There are hundreds of gifts for pets big and pets small. Toys only at PetSmart, so special and new. They'll love the gifts. You'll love the value. Hurry to PetSmart today for your very best friend and save 30 to 50% before the holiday ends.
The holidays are just around the corner. Go to PetLifeRadio.com/PetSmart and save up to 30% on awesome gifts for the pets and pet people in your life. Toys, collars, leashes, PetSmart gift cards, treats, and more. So shop early and save money. Go to PetLifeRadio.com/PetSmart today.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Horowitz, thank you so much for being with us. I know this Zubiquity conference that you're planning, number 2 for Los Angeles, is really something very different. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in understanding that MDs and veterinarians really need to work together.
Well, yes. I mean, I have been a cardiologist at UCLA for many years, taking care of human patients. And then I was given this wonderful opportunity to spend some time working with and observing the veterinarians at the Los Angeles Zoo. And there I realized for the first time that veterinarians are leading a kind of a parallel life to us physicians. They're taking care of the same problems in their patients, but that they have many unique and very effective strategies for dealing with the same problems that we confront in our human patients, but we physicians rarely talk to veterinarians. So through that experience at the LA Zoo, I became really interested in, along with my co-author, Catherine Bowers, how human medicine, how physicians and nurses and psychotherapists, people who take care of human beings, might improve the care of human patients by learning from veterinarians how they take care of their patients.
I am so impressed that you've adopted this philosophy, because there are times when some of my pet owners will be coming in, their MDs, and I'll say, oh, and by the way, your pet has breast cancer. And they'll look at me as like, are you kidding? Pets can get breast cancer too. It's like, we're all mammals. We share so many things. I mean, sometimes people don't realize that under the fur and feathers and fins and scale and skin, we're so remarkably alike. We share so many of the genes and medical issues. What are some of the medical issues that you've seen that people share with their animals?
Yeah, I can relate to that your physician client's experience, because in the beginning of this project, every time I would come upon a new diagnosis in an animal, I had this moment of, oh my goodness, dogs get this, cats get this, whales get this, etc., kangaroos. So it went on and on. But yes, I mean, the overlap between the diseases of humans and animals is nearly complete. So we're talking about, let's use your example of breast cancer. So breast cancer has been seen in mammals ranging from dogs and cats to kangaroos to beluga whales to alpacas, and you name it, pretty much it's been seen. And there's some really interesting things we can learn about human breast cancer by learning about breast cancer in animals. For example, there are some mammals who have a very low incidence of breast cancer, and those are the dairy cows and dairy goats, what some veterinarians call professional lactators. These animals who breastfeed basically their whole lives, they have a very, very low incidence of breast cancer. And that tracks with the human experience of breastfeeding as being protective against breast cancer. But it goes beyond cancer. Of course, it turns out animals also can develop heart disease, forms of congestive heart failure. We studied and wrote about diabetes in ponies and in cats. We learned about infections, everything from the flu, which of course can occur in many different species of animals, but even sexually transmitted diseases. So it really went on and on. And as Catherine and I started exploring how much of an overlap is there, we literally were unable to find a single disorder that was quote unquote uniquely human.
And it was interesting because this is my second interview of the day, and the first was with another Dr. Horowitz, spelled a little differently, and she is a veterinary animal behaviorist, and we were talking about the psychological issues, and that is shared amongst human and animals also, the separation anxiety, where you have that young child who's just toddling off to school, and they're like, ah! Give me my mommy. I need my mommy. Mm-hmm. Or the pet that's left at home and starts destroying the house because where's my mommy? I need my daddy. And they left me here all by myself.
Yeah, you know, this was really a surprise and absolutely fascinating for us to learn about. We were asking the question, you know, and by the way, the way that this book kind of unfolded is that we decided if I saw any condition, any diagnosis in a human patient at UCLA during the day, we would look for it in the veterinary literature in the evening. And, you know, that's how we started with breast cancer and leukemia and heart failure and diabetes. But we ended up ultimately, you know, asking the same questions about psychiatric problems. And one of the first we came upon was obsessive-compulsive disorder, that's OCD. And it turns out that there are many animals, dogs are, you know, certain breeds of dogs even are notorious for that, who can develop a kind of compulsive behaviors that look a lot like certain kinds of compulsive behaviors with OCD. For example, some human beings who have OCD engage in lots of grooming. They may wash their hands over and over and over. There can be a lot of cleansing kinds of rituals. And interestingly, some dogs who have compulsions will lick and lick and lick, again, this grooming or cleansing behavior, until it really interferes with their life, the quality of their life, and can even, in some cases, inflict damage on their skin. And what's even more interesting is that the veterinary experts who take care of what is known as canine compulsive disorder, if it occurs in dogs, of course it happens in other animals as well, but they use the same kinds of psychiatric medications that human physicians use to treat OCD in human beings, drugs like Prozac and related serotonin reuptake inhibitor drugs. So it's not only the behavior and the phenomena of OCD and canine compulsive disorders is the same, it's the response to the medication. So these are very connected behaviors. Another psychiatric syndrome that was surprising to learn about was self-injury. I remember one day I was seeing a young woman who came in for palpitations. So she'd come to the cardiac clinic for, you know, palpitations in her chest. But while I was examining her heart, I looked and I saw that on the inside of her left forearm, there were lots of horizontal healed scars. And I realized that she was a self-injurer, what some psychiatrists call a cutter. She was cutting herself. And I thought, well, my goodness, this must be uniquely human. I mean, it just seems so disordered, and I couldn't imagine that there could be any animal who would injure themselves. But went home that evening and began learning that not only is it not uniquely human, self-injury is common in many species of animals. So we're talking about self-injuring that includes, in some dogs, for example, licking and licking and licking until the skin breaks, something called acrylic dermatitis, and there are other names for it. There are also some horses, some stallions, who start to bite themselves, and they're called flank biters, and they can do so much biting that they can break the skin and really injure themselves. And even birds, we learned about, for example, parrots. There are some parrots that peck at their skin and peck and peck and peck until the skin bleeds. And
cockatoos, yes, it's horrible to watch it in them.
And then other birds who will pluck out their feathers. It's called feather plucking disorder. And this seemed so reminiscent of a human psychiatric disorder that is called trichotillomania, which is a condition in which human patients pluck out the hairs typically on their face. Their eyelashes are a typical target, but other body hair. There are just so many overlapping behaviors in such a wide spectrum of animal species with the human case. So this was revelatory to me and really made me begin to wonder what kind of knowledge psychiatrists and psychotherapists might glean from talking with veterinarians and veterinary behaviorists who successfully manage these self-injuring behaviors in their patients.
I think one of the other, I see it coming into the practice so frequently, a real health issue amongst animals and people is obesity. So many times it's hard for a veterinarian to try and broach the subject of obesity because the owner is sitting there, they're horribly overweight or overweight, and you feel as though you don't want to bring it up because you don't want to be disrespectful to them, to, you know, cause some type of a rift between this bond that we have. But we're learning more and more, no, we need to address it. And so many times as I do try and just focus in on the animal, the owner will look at themselves going, yeah, I'm kind of overweight too. And they start to realize that the medical problems that I'm talking about that can affect the pet, oh yeah, my knees are having a hard time getting up and I'm watching that in my overweight cat. It doesn't want to jump up on the bed as easily. So there are times I feel as though I can really help the entire family because if I address an issue in the pet, many times it spills over into the human aspect.
Yeah, you know, obesity is such a challenge to physicians such as myself also. We have more and more patients who are overweight. And as you know, as a veterinarian, now almost 40% of our dogs and cats are in the overweight to obese category. So these are two obesity epidemics that are happening in our homes, not just the human problem. One approach to obesity, which I learned from talking to veterinarians, which I think would be really helpful for human patients and physicians who take care of patients who have weight issues, is that veterinarians typically look at obesity more as a disease of the environment, whereas we physicians typically talk to the individual patient and we say to that patient, you need to cut back on your carbs or you need to get up and exercise more. A veterinarian obviously can't give verbal instructions to a patient, but what they can do is talk to the owner, talk to their client about changing the environment, making it more difficult for the animal to access food, creating a more of an exercise environment. And we learned that wildlife biologists recognize that groups of wild animals, from birds to whales to elk, that their weight will go up and down based on one thing, which is the state of the environment. So I think there's a really philosophical approach, difference of approach that veterinarians use in thinking about obesity that could be so helpful to physicians.
I think one of the aspects that veterinarians tend to also focus on is lifestyle. Yes, the environment, where you may have one person who thinks that they're the one responsible for feeding the pet. But then when you get more into the dynamics of the family, finding that, oh, grandma's living there and grandma's feeding, and then the neighbor's giving some treats. And a couple of years ago, I was fortunate to attend a conference being put on by Pfizer Animal Health, and they brought in a psychologist for children and talking about the psychology of the parents overfeeding the children and sometimes being the cultural aspects of it. And trying to relate that into my practice, going, oh, it does make a major difference how the family views food, the comfort that it brings. Giving food is giving love. It's like, okay, there's other things that we can do for love other than giving that treat.
That's so interesting. And in that case, also, the animal can be a kind of sentinel or a kind of an early warning sign to what's happening to the rest of the family. If somebody is overfeeding the animal, yeah, might also be overfeeding a toddler or... Yeah, it's very, I mean, and it really reinforces, the writing's ubiquity really helped me see over and over how interconnected our own health is with the health of our pets. Everything from, as you're talking about, feeding and obesity to, you know, exposure to toxins in the home and infectious risks. I'll tell you one thing that was really surprising to me was the issue of even domestic violence. You know, I learned that when there is domestic violence that's identified in homes against children and spouses, that very often there also has been violence against animals. These connections go on and on. Our health, whether it's physical or psychological, is very connected to our animals' health.
There are so many things that are connected, and I hope that people will stay connected to this radio show as we take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
It's the holidays at PetSmart, so come one and all. There are hundreds of gifts for pets big and pets small. Toys only at PetSmart, so special and new. They'll love the gifts. You'll love the value. Hurry to PetSmart today for your very best friend and save 30 to 50% before the holiday ends.
The holidays are just around the corner. Go to PetLifeRadio.com/PetSmart and save up to 30% on awesome gifts for the pets and pet people in your life. Toys, collars, leashes, PetSmart gift cards, treats, and more. So shop early and save money. Go to PetLifeRadio.com/PetSmart today.
Dyson.
The new Dyson Animal Vacs are powerful bagless upright vacuums for homes with pets. Air muscle and radio root cyclone technology generates the strongest suction power to powerfully remove dust, dirt, and pet hair from the home or car. To order your Dyson Animal Vac, go to DysonDeals.com. DysonDeals.com to order your Dyson Animal Vac today.
Dyson, music to your ears.
Hi, I'm Lisa Smith Putnam, the host of the new and exciting show, Your Pets, My Dogs, here on Pet Life Radio. Your Pets, My Dogs will feature celebrity interviews, we'll talk to everyday pet owners, and more. Listen, I am here to entertain you each and every week, right here on Pet Life Radio. Again, that's Your Pets, My Dogs. I'm your host, Lisa Smith Putnam.
Your Pets, My Dogs.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Horowitz, it is so refreshing to see an MD who realizes that there is such a connection between veterinary medicine, human medicine, and that we all share so many maladies and can actually benefit from. And I know one of the things that I tend to do, and I know my colleagues tend to do, if we have a question about medicine, we'll see, what are our human counterparts doing? What are they doing? And we can learn so much from you, but it sounds as though MDs are now also learning from veterinarians.
Oh, definitely. You know, when Catherine Bowers and I were writing this book, we came upon a number of vets who told us a little joke about, you know, human physicians. They said, well, you know, all doctors are basically veterinarians since human beings are animals. But we physicians are veterinarians with a single species focus. And what is really interesting is if you take that perspective, then we physicians are the only doctors who use language to make diagnoses. But of course, veterinarians are diagnosing the same diseases in a multitude of species without a patient who says, oh, it hurts here, or I was short of breath when I walked up the stairs. So one of the things that I think we can learn, we physicians can learn from veterinarians, is how to use observation and inspection, how a patient meaning, you know, taking one's time, appraisal of a patient can really lead to excellent information to making a diagnosis. Because on the human side, very, very often we're rushed. We simply ask the patient for a couple of lines, and that sort of helps direct where we go. We also thought it was very interesting that veterinarians, when we would observe them doing a physical exam on an animal, they have to be very calm. Their bedside manner is very important in terms of the patient's sense of comfort and trust in the veterinarian. And that, too, I think is a good takeaway for medical students who are learning to examine human patients, because people are nervous when they're at the hospital or when they're at the doctor's office. And, you know, learning that calm demeanor, I think, could be very valuable.
Well, anytime an MD wants to come to my practice and shadow me for a day, I would love to have them come in, and I'll do the same with them. My brother-in-law is an MD surgeon, and I've learned a lot from him. So, yes, it is definitely a two-way street. One of the things you were talking about earlier as we were getting into this was some of the psychological conditions that humans and animals have. And I know addiction is such a problem. And I have to laugh because I have some catnip growing outside, and one of my cats loves to go out there, and she'll roll, and she'll just, I call it my kitty marijuana, because she just seems to get so into this. Besides cats liking catnip, are there other instances of pets seeking out psychoactive substances?
Yes. I mean, this was one of the big surprises. Again, we asked, do animals ever get high? And we fully expected the answer to be no. This was uniquely human. And again, we quickly learned that wasn't the case, that many species of animals are notorious for doing it. So just a little a sample, waxwing birds are well known to selectively eat fermented berries, and then it's called flying while intoxicated. They become intoxicated, they fly, and it's actually very sad. They sometimes fly into buildings and have trauma and die. And we talked to veterinary pathologists who had done necropsies, which are animal autopsies, on these poor birds who had basically succumbed to substances. Also, a bighorn sheep in the Canadian Rockies, they love this hallucinogenic lichen that grows on the rocks, and they will scale very, very steep cliffs to get access to this lichen. They then grind it against their teeth so that they can get it into their systems, and they like it so much that in some cases they will literally grind their teeth down to the gums to get access to the lichens. We also learned about the wallabies of Tasmania. Now, there are medical opium fields in that region, and the wallabies, you know, live nearby. Some of the wallabies will jump over the fences that exist to get access to the poppies. They will eat the poppy sap and the poppy straw, and they get intoxicated. And what's so interesting is that it seems as though some of the wallabies want to go back over and over to get the poppies. Others of them will go once, and that seems to be enough, and others of them seem not interested. So, again, so many parallels to human substance use and addiction. And one thing that I just thought was so important about knowing that animals also seek substances in the wild is I think it can help destigmatize addiction in human patients, because it's such a horrible problem. It is so based in biology, and yet so many patients who suffer from substance abuse and addiction feel so much shame and guilt and self-blame. And I think knowing that this is a species-spanning problem can maybe reduce some of that self-blame.
If somebody would have asked, and that's one of the things I love about this show and this opportunity that I have to speak to people such as yourself, if somebody had asked me, do animals seek out these substances, I would have said, no. You know, maybe cats with kitty marijuana. But yes, this does make such a difference of understanding why some people, you know, they're not just weak. Maybe it's something genetic, something in their bodies that will cause them to do this or make them more prone to having the problem. Another idea is we know that there are people that have sexual addictions. They just, they cannot help themselves. They have to have sex, dangerous sex, whatever. And you talk to people about animals. It's like, no, they do it for procreation purposes only. But I have a feeling you're going to tell me, no, I do know about bonobos, but are there other animals other than these primates that have sex just for the quote-unquote fun of it?
Right. The bonobos, they seem to be really notorious for being the kind of sexaholics of the animal world, but they are not alone. And yeah, I learned so much in writing this chapter called Roargasm about animal sexuality. I guess I just...
Roargasm?
Yes. The chapter's called Roargasm.
Yeah. I love it.
Self-explanatory. I frankly had never thought about it, that animals have sex to procreate, to create babies, and that we humans, we have sex to, of course, to procreate, but also for pleasure. And looking back at, you know, why I just never had, but we began interviewing experts and doing research, and we learned that there are many aspects of animal sexuality that are non-procreative. So, for example, there's a lot of documentation of masturbation in animal species, both wild and domestic. Certainly, many of us have dogs who have embarrassed us during dinner parties when the guests arrive, and their legs become amorous objects. But there are many species, from bulls to camels to even insects, that self-stimulate as part of their daily life. And we also learned that there is quite a lot of same sexual activity in a very wide spectrum of animal species, from primates to non-primate mammals, even to amphibians and reptiles. So again, lots of evidence in the natural world of non-procreative sexual activity among animals.
Now, sometimes it is for dominance, but have they shown that it's also done for pleasure?
Right. So the question is, you know, why are they doing it? And of course, we can't ask an animal, but we can look at when they do it and what it looks like. So the self-stimulation does connect, we think, to a grooming activity. And of course, animals use grooming to stay clean, but they also use grooming to relax themselves, to bond with other animals, whether they're self-grooming or they're grooming someone else. And this self-stimulation, even if it's sexual, probably is also part of that grooming function, that kind of relaxation, and that does, I think, connect to pleasure. We also do quite a bit of research, and we learned that there are animals in whom orgasm has been documented, and in other animals, the behavior seems to resemble quite significantly orgasm. Now, whether it's exactly the same as the human case, we don't know, and the answer is probably it's not exactly the same, but we think there are probably significant connections, and it may be one of the ways that an animal is incentivized to have more sex is that pleasure accompanies the act.
And along with sex oftentimes comes other problems, such as sexually transmitted diseases. I know in veterinary medicine, with regard to the patients I see, cats and dogs, brucellosis is a sexually transmitted disease. And if you're having a breeding program of dogs, it's a test that is done to make sure that we don't spread that disease. With your research, what other sexually transmitted diseases are out there in the animal world?
Yeah, well, we found tons and tons of them, which is really not that surprising because, let's face it, animals have sex with multiple partners and they don't practice safe sex. There are no condoms in the animal world. So it's not really surprising that there would be STDs. We learned, for example, that there is syphilis in rabbits, bunny syphilis. There are herpes in dolphins. And I mean, it goes on, and we have quite an extensive list of them and sort of explanation of them. But one of the most striking epidemics of a sexually transmitted disease that's going on right now involves koalas, those cuddly koalas of Australia. There is a chlamydia epidemic amongst the koalas of Australia.
And chlamydia people get.
Exactly. It's not the same exact strain, but it's very similar, and it has similar effects. It can affect the animal's fertility, just as chlamydia can affect the fertility of a woman if she has the infection. And yeah, I mean, and there are lots of things that we can learn about sexually transmitted diseases in humans by studying this in wild populations, and also some of the work that is being done to develop a vaccine for koala chlamydia could translate over to the human side and help us prevent chlamydia among human patients.
I love that tie-in where all of a sudden you'd say, you know, why do you want to go through all this work? You know, it's just a dumb animal. Yes, it's a cute little koala, so that takes it up the list of people wanting to spend money on it. But it's like, here is that tie-in of helping this wild animal, this population, and then helping humans at the same time.
If we allow ourselves as human beings to really recognize that we are human animals, I think that just opens up a different and more expanded way of thinking about ourselves. And that's true whether we're a physician or a patient.
There was a movie that came out a few years ago, Contagion, and I think it was one of the most disturbing movies that I've seen because the reality is there of a virus that came from a bat to a pig to a person and then became a pandemic spread throughout the world. What are your thoughts of these emerging zoonotic diseases, diseases that are spread and shared between animals and people?
Well, it's a really important question and problem. And, you know, when we first started looking at the connections between animal and human health, this is the first issue that came up because it seems the most kind of pressing. But, and of course, as the book deals with, as you're saying, we talk about eating disorders and sexuality and adolescence and all these non-infectious questions. However, it does turn out that about 60% of the dangerous infections that are emerging and that can really cause epidemics or pandemics in humans come from what we call the animal reservoir. So just today, for example, there are lots and lots of articles about hantavirus. And, of course, West Nile virus in Texas currently, you know, there are a great percentage of the mosquitoes are carrying West Nile. And so all of these infections come from the animal reservoir. And if you look at diseases like SARS and H1N1 or bird flu, I mean, all of these big scares do come from animal sources. And that doesn't mean that animals are the enemy, the opposite. What it means is that we physicians and other human healthcare providers need to stay in very close touch with animal experts, with veterinarians and veterinary public health officials, and we need to do everything we can to keep animal populations safe and healthy. Because one of the reasons that these infections emerge is because of changes in damage to the animal's ecosystem, something called deforestation. And so having lots and lots of communication between animal health providers, wildlife biologists, ecologists, and physicians can help us not only track these infections, but also hopefully in some cases reduce the likelihood of dangerous ones emerging.
This is exciting. It is disturbing. It is just something I think all people need to learn more about, the interrelationship of human health, animal health, and our world's health. If people want to learn more about your book, Dr. Horowitz, where should they go? How can they purchase your book?
Well, first of all, thank you for those kind words. Yeah, I mean, the book is available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble's and other bookstores. We have a website, you know, www.zidakuti.com. And we actually have a conference coming up where veterinarians and physicians are going to be talking about the same diseases in different species. We're going to look at bullying in animals and in humans, self-injury in adolescents and in animals. We're going to look at breast cancer and infertility this year. So there's lots to learn, and the book is available pretty much everywhere, at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, among others.
Well, I'm happy to say that I am going to be attending that conference, looking forward to it, knowing that we also get to go to the Los Angeles Zoo after visiting UCLA and doing walking rounds there. So I know it's just open to MDs, veterinarians, and other health professionals, but hopefully people will want to pick up your book, Zoobiquity, What Animals Can Teach Us About Health and the Science of Healing. So Dr. Natterson Horowitz, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And if you want to learn more about how you can be the best pet owner possible and learn more about your health, please tune in again next week. And this is Dr. Bernadine Cruz with a Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. the Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.